Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Regina, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, highlights from the 2024 American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting. The theme is the art and science of cancer care, from comfort to cure. And today's program is supported by Bristol Myers Squibb and Novartis Oncology. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I just want to say a few words about the call today. We do have over 300 participants on this call today, and you come from all of the United States, from all different areas, from both urban, suburban, frontier, and rural communities. And we also have international participants today from Canada, India, and the United Kingdom. So it is really a global call as well. And we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today. And now, it's really my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Kamal Abu Hussein. And Dr. Hussein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, Adjunct Assistant Professor, Department of Breast Medical Oncology, MD Anderson Cancer Center, Co-Director of the Janet Knowles Breast Cancer Program, Director of Breast Cancer Clinical Trials, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. And Dr. Hussein will be addressing an overview of ASCO's 2024 theme, the art and science of cancer care from comfort to cure. And he'll also be presenting specific updates on the treatment of breast cancer presented at ASCO. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hussein.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner, for the kind presentation. Hi, everybody. As usual, the ASCO meeting of this year has been full of a lot of updates, and breast cancer has taken a fair share of those updates. I've chosen a few of the new information presented in order to discuss them today, and hopefully we'll discuss the rest of the information in the upcoming workshops. So first, I would like to start by discussing the results of the Destiny Breast 06. This is, or was really, an eagerly anticipated trial showing that Enhertu, which is one of the antibody drug conjugates, also known as trastuzumab deruxtecan, is better than chemotherapy for women with metastatic HER2-low and HER2-ultra-low disease. Now, in this trial, they recruited patients with metastatic hormone receptor-positive breast cancer who had a lower level of expression of the HER2 protein. Those patients had a cancer that has grown while being treated with hormonal therapy, and they compared the outcome of treating them with chemotherapy, common agents like Xeloda, Abraxane, or Taxol, versus Enhertu. And people with the HER2-low and the HER2-ultra-low lived about 13 months without disease growing. This is an endpoint that is commonly used in research referred to as progression-free survival, while patients who received chemotherapy lived about 8 months before the cancer grew. People who received Enhertu were able to stay on the medicine longer for about 11 months compared to only 6 months for the people who received chemotherapy alone. It is estimated when we test every patient for their HER2 status that about 85% of our patients with metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer could benefit from receiving this medication. Enhertu is approved by the FDA as a treatment for metastatic HER2-low breast cancer, but not the HER2-ultra-low. And because it's not FDA approved yet, it is unclear if the insurance will cover Enhertu for folks who have ultra-low disease. Also, the way that our traditional testing for the HER2 protein is not designed to clearly identify this ultra-low group with a high degree of certainty. So there's a lot of work to be done really in pathology, and there might be a need to introduce new advanced techniques to help us clearly identify this category of patients. Now, switching gears and discussing another exciting study that concluded that Taxotere is linked to less neuropathy in Black women. Now, neuropathy, as we know, is the tingling and numbness in the tips of the fingers and the toes. And in this study, they showed that Black women with early stage breast cancer who received the chemotherapy agent Taxotere every 3 weeks had less peripheral neuropathy than Black women who received the chemotherapy medicine called Taxol. Now, both of them are commonly used, and this is a very, very important side effect that we try to avoid or minimize as much as possible. And in this study, they included 239 Black women who were diagnosed with early stage breast cancer. And about half of the women received Taxol every week, and the other half received Taxotere every 3 weeks. And they found that a lower percentage of women receiving Taxotere reported this moderate to severe neuropathy compared to women receiving Taxol. So 25% of the women receiving Taxotere versus 44% of the women receiving Taxol had neuropathy. And this result was statistically significant between the two arms. And basically that tells us that this is likely due to the difference in treatment and not just because of chance. This trial does have important implications for Black women with early stage breast cancer, and it seems that every 3 weeks dosing of Taxotere may be a better option for our Black patients where neuropathy is more common and could impact the overall quality of life and the impact really the disease outcome, which is really important. We also reviewed the results of the post-MONARCH study, which showed that people with metastatic hormone receptor positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, who received Verzenio, also this drug is known as abemaciclib, plus Faslodex, after progressing on a combination of a CDK4/6 inhibitor and an aromatase inhibitor, lived longer without the cancer growing compared to those who received Faslodex alone. So in this study, they looked at 368 patients who were either treated with Verzenio and Faslodex versus placebo and Faslodex. And the patients enrolled directly after progressing on a prior line of therapy that was composed of a CDK4/6 inhibitor along with an endocrine therapy partner for the treatment of their metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer. Now, it's really important to note that the majority of those patients, maybe about 60%, were treated with Ibrance, and 33% were treated with Kisqali in the first line, and only 8% were treated with Verzenio. Now remember, we did see a benefit previously from an earlier phase clinical trial called the MAINTAIN trial, applying the same philosophy, but they used Kisqali or ribociclib as a CDK for a 6 inhibitor to switch to after prior treatment with a CDK4/6 inhibitor and aromatase inhibitor. Overall, I think it's a very good thing, and it gives us options for switching therapy after progression on the first-line CDK-based therapy. Now, a very important question that we commonly face in clinic is a patient who has a low level of estrogen expression. Those are called low expressors, and when it comes or presents itself in the early stage breast cancer setting, and their estrogen expression is anywhere between 1 to 10%, and we wonder whether endocrine therapy or hormonal therapy would provide any benefit or not. So in this study, they looked at the records of almost 8,000 patients who were diagnosed with either stage 1, 2, or 3 and had an ER low expression. Those patients received chemotherapy, and about 59% of those patients received hormonal or endocrine therapy. And at the end, they were able to conclude that patients who didn't take the endocrine therapy had worse overall survival and were about 20% more likely to die during follow-up than people who took their endocrine therapy. And this data is very helpful and quite suggestive of the importance of counseling patients regarding the benefit of their hormonal or the endocrine therapy after surgery when they have an ER low disease. We also saw an update from the RxPONDER or the RxPONDER trial, which was previously published in order to decide on the potential benefit of chemotherapy in patients with 1 to 3 positive lymph nodes. And previously, we've seen those results, which showed that premenopausal patients always had benefit from chemotherapy, and postmenopausal patients didn't unless they score above a certain threshold on that test, on the Oncotype test. And the way they broke patients down is anybody below the age of 50 was considered premenopausal, and if they had a menstrual cycle in the last year, they were considered premenopausal. And so in this trial, they took patients that are below the age of 55 of age, either pre- or postmenopausal, but it's not always easy to accurately determine the menopausal status of a woman in clinic. So instead, they looked at them by the level of AMH. AMH is short for basically, this is a measure of the ovarian follicular reserve, and they split them by low or medium high AMH. And similar to what we saw of the pre versus postmenopausal, patients that had a low AMH, meaning did not have ovarian function reserve, we would call those patients kind of advanced perimenopausal patients that did not have a benefit from the addition of chemotherapy to endocrine therapy. Now, how can this help us in our practice? Would be a case in those patients that are at right at the edge and they are on the fence of whether to proceed with chemotherapy or not, then this could be used as a tiebreaker or something else to order in order to figure out if this borderline woman in age is close enough to being postmenopausal, and that way they could be grouped with the postmenopausal group and potentially sparing them chemotherapy as they're unlikely to derive benefit from the intervention and eventually sparing them unnecessary side effects. One other very important study was the INAVO 120 study, which focused on patients with disease that is very difficult to treat. And those are patients who progressed during or within 12 months of getting their endocrine therapy in the adjuvant or post-surgical setting for early-stage breast cancer. And those are patients that have never received any treatment in the metastatic setting. And they harbored a mutation called the PIK3CA mutation. This is a mutation that is present in about 40% of our patients in total. They randomized them into one of two groups. The first group was treated with Ibrance, fulvestrant, and a new PIK3CA inhibitor called inavolisib. And the other group was treated with a combination of Ibrance, fulvestrant, and a placebo. Now, this mutation, as we said, is present in a large number of our patients, roughly 40% of the hormone receptor positive HER2-negative breast cancer patients. And at the median follow-up, they saw that the progression-free survival was more than twice as long for people who received inavolisib versus the other group. And the information regarding the overall survival was not ready to be analyzed yet. So quite promising. This triplet combination may represent a new standard of care for our patients with the PIK3CA mutation in the advanced hormone receptor positive breast cancer setting. Now, definitely it comes with some significant side effects, including but not limited to mouth sores, diarrhea, skin rash, and nausea, but comparing it to a prior drug called Piqray, which also used to target this very mutation, it's a lot better tolerated with significantly less side effect profile. Now, at this point, I will stop because I want to be respectful of everyone's time, but you will notice that I did not talk about any updates regarding the triple negative setting, and I'm hoping to see you all next month in the next workshop where we will focus on triple negative breast cancer disease. Thank you all, and back to you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. That was just a wonderful presentation, and thank you so much. I think people learned a great deal from your presentation. It's worth asking people. This will be available also. This whole program will be available as a podcast within about a week after the program, and so you can listen to it again if you wish. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Deborah Richardson. Dr. Richardson is Professor, Section Chief, Division of Gynecologic Oncology, Stephenson Cancer Center, OU Health, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And Dr. Richardson will be addressing specific updates on the treatment of ovarian cancer presented at ASCO and the role of clinical trials, how research increases treatment options.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner, for the kind invitation and introduction. I'm excited to give this update today. I don't have as many great updates as we just heard in breast, but there are things coming that I want you to be excited about. So for one thing, when we talk about ovarian cancer, we are also including fallopian tube cancer and primary peritoneal cancer. And there are different cell types of ovarian cancer, the most common of which is high-grade serous, and most of the research does concentrate on that cell type, and that's mostly what I'm going to be reviewing today, although I will point out when there are some other updates, and there was one exciting trial about clear cell ovarian cancer this year. So when the majority of patients are diagnosed with ovarian cancer, it tends to be an advanced stage of stage 3 or 4, and patients get a combination of both surgery and chemotherapy and potentially maintenance therapy as well. So first, we're going to start at the front line. And the first trial I want to talk about is a trial called the CARACO trial. And this was a multi-center trial, phase 3, that took patients with epithelial ovarian cancer that were stage 3 or 4, and they randomized patients who were undergoing surgery for a debulking surgery to either do a lymph node dissection or not. And what they found was that there was not a benefit in how long the cancer would come back if a lymph node dissection was included routinely. But by doing that lymph node dissection, we actually had more severe complications within 30 days of surgery. And that included more likely to give a blood transfusion. There was more likelihood of needing re-intervention or more procedures. And there was also a higher rate of urinary injury. And so the important part of this study is that there is no role for a routine lymph node dissection in ovarian cancer debulking. And that's important for us to know so that we can reduce harm and we are not hurting patients by doing that. The next trial I want to talk about is the NANT trial. So there are a couple trials we're going to talk about today that are similar. We have a question of whether or not does everybody need platinum-based chemotherapy to start, or could we use a different treatment? And so there are drugs called PARP inhibitors. There are three main ones used in ovarian cancer, olaparib, rucaparib, or niraparib. And so this trial took patients with advanced ovarian cancer who had a test that was positive for what's called homologous recombination deficiency, and that's a test that's done on the tumor. We know that about 50% of high-grade serous and endometrioid ovarian cancer are going to be homologous recombination deficient, and that test predicts likelihood of response to PARP inhibitors. So these patients then got niraparib and were given it for 2 cycles. And typically when we do what's called neoadjuvant therapy, so therapy prior to surgery, it's usually 3 or 4 cycles. But they didn't want to, since we didn't have a lot of data about how safe this was or what might happen, they limited it to 2 cycles. And then as long as the disease did not grow on that, they then went on to surgery. They then went on to get the standard of care chemotherapy followed by niraparib maintenance versus standard therapy if the cancer grew during the PARP treatment. And what they found was that 48 patients of 67 who enrolled were able to complete the neoadjuvant PARP. And the response rate was quite good. It was 62.5%, and the remainder, 25%, had stable disease. So only 5 patients' cancer grew during the PARP treatment in neoadjuvant. And actually, for patients who had a BRCA mutation, they had 100% disease control rate and a higher response rate of 77%. And at the time of surgery, the outcomes from surgery were quite good. Our goal when we do surgery for ovarian cancer is to try and get to what we call complete gross resection. And 80% of these patients were able to get a complete gross resection, and 95% had what we call an optimal debulking, where less than 1 centimeter tumor was left behind. The next trial is somewhat similar. Again, question, can we replace frontline platinum with non-platinum options, non-chemo options? And so this is another drug another trial of PARP inhibitor olaparib with a checkpoint inhibitor pembrolizumab, again in homologous recombination deficient ovarian cancer. And again, it was two cycles, and then the patients went on to debulking surgery. This was a small trial. It enrolled 20 patients. But again, they had a very good response rate of 70%, very similar to the trial I just talked about. And they did give, some of these patients went on to get more chemotherapy prior to undergoing surgery. They were able to get to an 88% complete gross resection. Again, that's very high. Now, something that was a little bit different in this trial is they did have more patients with germline mutations in the BRCA1 or 2 gene, 65%, and overall 75% of the patients on this trial did have a germline mutation in a cancer-causing gene. They did not have any patients who had progression while on the PARP inhibitor. And so this is very exciting. We need more data, but it is possible that we will be able to give some patients a non-chemo option prior to surgery. This year, there were no big phase three frontline trials read out at ASCO. However, we did find out while we were at ASCO that the Athena combo trial, which was looking at giving rucaparib, which is again another PARP inhibitor, plus another checkpoint inhibitor, nivolumab, as maintenance for upfront ovarian cancer, that trial was negative. It did not improve outcomes compared to rucaparib alone, and that's important. That means that we don't need to give a two-drug maintenance regimen in that setting. Next, we're going to talk about some trials in the platinum-sensitive recurrent setting, and what that means is that the cancer has grown back at least 6 months after the last platinum therapy. So the first trial is called the SOC1 trial, and this was a trial done in China looking at the role of what we call secondary debulking, so when the patient has been in remission and then the cancer recurs, whether or not we should go back to the operating room. And they used very strict criteria for this, and this was the final overall survival results. What they found was that in the overall group, there was not a benefit in overall survival to surgery. However, they had one center who had a lot of patients go on to another debulking surgery when they recurred again. When they took those patients out, they actually did see a 21-month improvement in overall survival for those patients who underwent surgery. So that kind of reinforces that there is probably a role for a secondary surgery in select patients. Also in the platinum-sensitive setting, there was a trial called the NEO trial, and this again took patients who were platinum-sensitive who had not seen a PARP inhibitor before, and they had to be a patient who was could undergo a cytoreductive surgery. They gave them 6 weeks of the PARP inhibitor olaparib, and then after that, they were randomized to either receive the standard of care platinum-based chemotherapy after surgery or and followed by olaparib or olaparib alone. And what they found was that the progression-free survival and the overall survival looked fairly similar. So again, this may mean that not all patients need to get platinum-based chemotherapy, but these are small trials and we still need more data. The next trial I want to talk about is a trial called the CAPRI study, and this stands for combining ATR inhibitor and PARP inhibitor. And this combination is to target what we call replication stress, which is important when a cancer cell is trying to make copies of itself. And this, they had several different cohorts. The one that was presented was in the platinum-sensitive setting in patients who were BRCA wild type, in other words, did not have a BRCA mutation. Only two patients in this trial had had prior PARP inhibitor. And they had a very nice response rate of 49%. So that means almost 50% of the patients that went on this trial had a reduction in tumor size. And this seemed to be beneficial to both patients who were homologous recombination deficient test positive and negative, which is reassuring. In addition, patients were able to stay on this study for a while. The average patient stayed on over 7 months, and they still had five patients on trial when they presented this data, and one patient was on for 46 months and still on when they presented. So some patients were able to get quite a bit of benefit from this combination. The most common side effects of this combination included nausea, fatigue, anemia, diarrhea, and headache. Next, I want to move on to platinum resistant, and when we talk about platinum resistance in ovarian cancer trials, what we are saying is that the cancer grew back within 6 months of the last platinum. And this is really interesting. This took patients with platinum resistant cancer, and they all got a biopsy, and then it was sent for a test called chemo-ID. And that was looking for 12 different regimens, half of which were just single agent standard chemos, and the other were combination chemos that were platinum based. And then the patients were randomized to either physician choice chemotherapy, and the physicians did not know the results of the chemo ID test, or they were received chemo ID guided chemotherapy. And what we found out was that the chemo ID guided group did a lot better than the physician choice group. In fact, the likelihood of response was 55% when it was chemo ID guided, compared to only 5% when it was physician choice. In addition, patients' cancer took a lot longer to grow back when they had chemo ID guided treatment over physician choice. And they were also able to remain on that treatment longer when it was chemo ID guided. So one thing to know about this trial is it does not have any of the novel agents available. For example, there's a new drug called mirvetuximab or Elahere, which is an antibody drug conjugate. None of these new treatments were on, but for patients who maybe don't have those as options because their tumors don't express the correct proteins, this might be helpful in picking the next drug regimen. The next trial I wanted to discuss is using a drug called Batiraxept or AVB-500, which is basically a decoy to a receptor or protein on the cancer surface called AXL, AXL. And we know that AXL is overexpressed on a lot of ovarian cancer. And so they took this drug and added it to one of our standard of care chemotherapies called weekly paclitaxel. And overall, the addition of this drug did not do better than weekly Taxol alone. But we found out that in high AXL, the patients did much better when they were given Batiraxept in addition to weekly Taxol. Currently, this drug is not being further developed at this time, but this trial was really important because it taught us some important lessons about how to better design trials, because the patients who had low AXL actually did worse when they were given this study drug in addition to Taxol. And so we need to do better in designing our trials to make sure that we are going to get the best outcomes for our patients. And then I promised you that I would discuss this trial in clear cell. So this was exciting because we don't have a lot of data in clear cell ovarian cancer. And so this was a trial done by Dr. Dizon, which looked at a combination of immunotherapy called ipilimumab and nivolumab. And they took patients with ovarian cancer who had clear cell. A third of the patients had a response, which is very high for clear cell. So 10 out of 30 patients that they enrolled. And the toxicity was as expected when we're giving immunotherapy. There was some fatigue, there was some itchiness, and there was some hypothyroidism, which is low thyroid that we can kind of replete with Synthroid. And the final trial I want to discuss is an antibody drug conjugate called RC88, which is an antibody drug conjugate that targets mesothelin. And that's a protein that's expressed on a lot of ovarian cancer. They enrolled 83 patients. Most of the patients had high mesothelin expression, 76 out of 83. And the response rate was 42%. And that's very high. That's much higher than what we see with standard chemotherapy in this range, which is typically more in the 13%, 15% range. So this drug is still being developed, but that's very exciting. So in conclusion, there were no big practice-changing trials in ovarian cancer at ASCO this year, but some might be coming soon. There's more research needed, but we may be able to treat some BRCA-mutated patients and homologous recombination-deficient tumor patients with PARP inhibitors as neoadjuvant therapy. I think ipilimumab, nivolumab is a great option for clear cell ovarian cancer. There are many exciting antibody-drug conjugates under development for ovarian cancer. So far, we have one approved, mirvetuximab, or you may know it as Elahere, for tumors that are folate receptor high. And participating in clinical trials can be beneficial to the volunteer and also helps people in the future with diagnosed with ovarian cancer. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. Dr. Richards, that was just a wonderful presentation. I think for everyone listening on the call today, you actually presented a lot of information on the treatment of ovarian cancer, the latest treatment, and also all the updates and trials that were done. So thank you so much. Just a wonderful presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Susan Sloven, and Dr. Sloven is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Walk College of Cornell University. And Dr. Sloven will be addressing specific updates on the treatment of prostate cancer presented at ASCO and talking with your healthcare team about your treatment choices. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sloven.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and hello, everyone. Dr. Messner pointed out earlier that at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, where we all go as to learn new things, that it's not always about drugs. Sometimes it's about improving quality of life for our patients and making them become more involved in their care. It's about looking at new and novel drugs. It's about looking at ways of predicting how a patient's cancer will respond to certain therapies. And more importantly, and it may seem a little odd, dispelling old rumors. And there's no greater example of that than what was presented regarding the drug metformin. Now, I'm sure many of you know or are on metformin. The other name for it is glucophage. It's an oral hypoglycemic agent, meaning it's an oral drug to treat abnormal sugars. And for a long time, people have expressed an interest in using a variety of these hypoglycemic agents to treat prostate cancer. Now, I have to say that in 2024, there's absolutely no reason for any patient to become desperate regarding any sort of treatment for prostate cancer. We probably have more treatments now than you could possibly use in your oncologic lifetime. But this has been coming up on multiple occasions. Patients come in, they talk about high doses of vitamins and very complementary approaches. But nevertheless, even in the absence of having diabetes for which this is used, patients have long sought a rationale to pursue the treatment of their cancer with metformin. So as many of you know, if you have low-risk prostate cancer, Gleason 6 in particular, you have three recommended options. One is what we call active surveillance, where interventions are largely event-driven, meaning that if you're being monitored regularly with MRI and blood work and a yearly or every other year biopsy, you can be surveyed for a very long time and do very well before you need to change to an active therapy such as surgery or radiation. Another is monitoring people, with other kinds of radiographic tests such as PSMA scans, or of course just starting an intervention by discussing what potential treatments one can use either to reduce the size of the prostate or reduce any kind of obstructive symptoms somebody has. Now, metformin or glucophage is approved for the treatment of type 2 diabetes, and it's been thought of for many years as having an anti-cancer effect. And as a result, there have been retrospective studies, there have been epidemiologic studies, and a variety of studies to support this. So I'm very pleased to say that the MAST trial, M-A-S-T, standing for Metformin Active Surveillance Trial, was performed in Canada in sort of a means to try to answer this question. Now, the group there looked at about 407 patients, or they're all low-grade prostate cancers and PSAs that are less than 10. They did what we call a double-blind randomized trial, which means that you have two groups of patients, one of whom is getting the metformin, the other getting a placebo drug. Neither the patients or the doctors know what they're getting. But at the end of the day, 204 patients got metformin, 203 received placebo. And it was interesting because they followed these patients for approximately 3 years. The standard dose of metformin is usually 500 milligrams twice daily, but they used a dose of 850 milligrams twice daily. So patients were followed for 3 years. And they did a very thorough job. They did a repeat prostate biopsy at 18 months and again at 36 months. And they looked at how long did it take to see if their cancer progressed and whether or not they needed to go on to any sort of definitive therapy. As it turns out, whether you had been on this drug or had been on placebo, about 141 patients actually had their disease progress in spite of being on drug. There was no statistical difference between the two groups. So I think for those patients who think that the way to prevent their cancer or treat their cancer is to use this drug, I think we have some very nice evidence that suggests that there is really no benefit to do this. Now, you know, if you do what we call a exploratory subgroup analysis, meaning that if you look at patients who have a higher body mass index or BMI, for example, a Gleason score of at least 8 at the time of their disease progression, it seems that they just did not benefit at all. They actually perhaps did worse on the metformin, suggesting that these men had a detriment from taking this drug. However, those who maybe had a score of at least Gleason 7 had, you know, maybe a little bit less disease progression. But at the end of the day, and aside from the side effects of those who were on the metformin having some diarrhea and bloating and abdominal pain and poor appetite, at the end of the day, there really was no benefit. So I would recommend for those of you who have, are listening that to be very circumspect if you elect to go forward with this treatment. Now, what else is exciting in the world has to do with variants in prostate cancer. So many of you may know that there's good old-fashioned adenocarcinoma, which is the usual kind of prostate cancer that we see under the microscope. But there are different variants in terms of what we can see. And one of the variants is something called neuroendocrine prostate cancer. Neuroendocrine refers to a type of cancer that under the microscope has dark blue stained cells, and sometimes it can actually look very much akin to what we call small cell lung cancer. It is not small cell lung cancer in any way, shape, or form, but does have an appearance and sometimes a level of metastases that rivals that of small cell lung cancer. So a drug called tarlatamab is what we call a bispecific T-cell engager, or BiTE. It's essentially an antibody that, which is a protein that is capable of binding an immune cell, which we call a T-cell on one side of the street, so to speak, and can actually have another side of it that binds to the actual tumor cell. So you're trying to get the immune system going at the same time that you are directing the treatment to the tumor cell as well. And it actually binds to a molecule on this particular type of prostate cancer called DLL3, Delta-like ligand 3. That's on the tumor cell, and a molecule called CD3, which is on the T cell. And there was some level of anti-tumor activity. So what's exciting about this? Well, this is only a phase 1, But there definitely was a signal. It was well tolerated. There were the usual side effects that we see with this kind of an immune therapy, which can be an infusion reaction, some fevers, some chills, a variety of body aches. But in general, you know, we do not have a standard of care for this type of cancer. We have been borrowing from the thoracic oncology literature using cisplatin and etoposide, which are the standards of care in that particular kind of lung cancer. However, while it may work for a lot of the patients initially, we really have nothing to go by that could be effective and to help people's disease remain in check. So this is something to look forward to, and we're looking for more development in the recommended phase 2 dose of this particular trial. There is the area of what we call radioligand. So many of you know now that Pluvicto, or lutetium-177, PSMA, has become a standard of care. It uses a radioactive compound, lutetium, that is hooked up to a small molecule that seeks out and brings the radiation to cells, prostate cancer cells, that express prostate-specific membrane antigen. The molecule is then encompassed by the cell membrane, brought into the cell where it is broken apart, freeing the radiation and causing the cells to die. Well, Pluvicto has been a standard of care now for a bit, and maybe 2 years. A lot of patients go on it after having had chemotherapy with docetaxel. It has improvement in quality of life, among other measures. However, it's always good to explore what other radioactive compounds can be used. So more recently, there has been interest in a molecule called HK2, which is a relative of PSA. It's a novel target that's expressed on the cell surface of prostate cancer cells and has very restricted expression elsewhere. So this was a first-in-class type of approach. It's they used an antibody against this particular molecule, and they hooked it up with actinium-225. It's a very high energy but very short range, as opposed to lutetium, which was a lower energy and a longer range. And this is what we call an alpha emitter, as opposed to lutetium and Pluvicto, which is a beta emitter. And this was a first in human study that looked to see if they can use this in patients who have had prior treatment with more than one androgen receptor pathway inhibitor, such as abiraterone or enzalutamide and the like. So over 67 patients were treated. Again, very small. This was really looking for safety and toxicity. And they noticed that there seemed to be a benefit in terms of clinical, which means how people were feeling, biochemical, which means reduction in PSA, and radiographic responses, which means on a PSMA PET scan, did they see, or other scans, did they see improvement? And there's a whole variety of other scans that were used. But they did find durable responses that were for over 112 weeks in many cases. So this is something where they are also are evaluating the phase two dose in order to build on it. And hopefully we'll go into a phase 3, which also provides, again, another treatment for patients with prostate cancer. And lastly, what I did want to keep everybody in mind, you know, we're always preaching about good diet, low-fat diet, activity. There is now a study that actually was done trying to see if one could associate a body mass index with physical activity. And over about 5,000 patients were reached by a telephone survey who had prostate cancer. And they looked at patients over the age of 65, of which about 78% fell into that group. And they found that those people who had high body mass indices, so on the hefty side, were less likely to do physical activity, and that the same was true for patients who smoked. Now, why is that relevant? Well, we're always, as physicians, trying to enhance physical activity and make people doing well. But they did find, through this survey of 5,000 people, that, you know, we're dealing with a chronic disease with prostate cancer. People can live longer, but that weight reduction and some form of physical activity still proves to be the best way of handling your disease in addition to what your doctors are prescribing for you. So I would encourage listeners out there to consider to incorporate this in one's armamentarium against the cancer. So if you're a smoker, try to cut back. If you are overweight or you feel that you meet the criteria of having a very high body mass index, please try to work with somebody to try to lose a little bit of weight. Doesn't have to be, you know, 30 pounds in a week, but if you can lose 1 pound in a week and keep on your track, you're going to do great. So there's a lot more to talk about. Unfortunately, I don't have the time, but thank you all for listening. And back to you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Slobin. That was a wonderful presentation, actually just very stellar, and lots of information for people listening who want to know more about prostate cancer and its treatment from ASCO. And a lot of excellent information. And again, this program will be available as a podcast within a week, so you'll be able to listen to the entire series. If you missed something or want to hear it again, stay tuned. You'll be able to listen to it. Okay. Thank you. Thanks. And our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. And Dr. Bruce is the Edgar M. Hausbein Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman of Academic Affairs, New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, Director Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory, Co-Director Brain Tumor Center. And Dr. Bruce will be addressing specific updates on the treatment of brain cancer presented at ASCO and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bruce.
Hello, everyone. Thanks, Carolyn. I'm really delighted to be here, and I'm grateful for Dr. Messner and the Cancer Care for these great teleconferences that they put together. I'm really excited to share with you a number of novel and promising updates for brain tumor research from the recent ASCO meeting, and I wanted to thank Nick D'Addario, one of my medical students, who helped me put this talk together. This ASCO meeting explored many exciting ongoing clinical trials and experimental treatments for brain tumor patients. And you may know that currently the standard of care treatment for glioma patients remains maximal safe resection followed by 6 weeks of radiation and chemotherapy with temozolomide, also known as Temodar. However, tumor recurrence is inevitable, and previous treatments soon no longer work on recurrent tumors as they become more resistant. So understanding how we can better therapeutically target these tumors as a team within the neuro-oncology field and help our patients is really at the heart of the ASCO meeting. At the same time, it gives us an important forum for clearly communicating our progress so other researchers can build off of this progress and develop better outcomes for patients with this difficult disease. Now, as I mentioned, tumor recurrence is inevitable in patients with high-grade glioma despite standard of care treatments. However, many groups at ASCO this year have continued to devise novel ways to improve the current tools and standard treatments that we have in our patients. Now, one exciting therapy is in recent years is the concept of tumor treating fields. And this involves a device that works by using electric fields to disrupt the very processes that are going on in tumor cells necessary for those tumor cells to live and grow. And the large clinical trial update on the tumor treating fields just reaffirmed its benefits among 710 patients with newly diagnosed glioblastoma that were analyzed. And this work showed that tumor treating fields successfully slowed tumor progression with very limited side effects. Now, one of the most exciting areas of glioma research is in immunotherapy. And to understand how immunotherapy works, think of when you get an infection, such as a virus or bacteria, your body mounts a vigorous immune response to get rid of that infection. Now, a similar thing happens when patients have tumors. The immune response that your body generates tries to get rid of the tumor cells. They're sort of looked up as foreign invaders like the bacteria or viruses. However, the problem is that the immune system is generally not strong enough to overcome the rapidly growing tumor. Also, the tumor cells are clever, and they disguise themselves and ultimately will block an immune response that can attack the tumor. ASCO has highlighted several immunotherapy strategies in previous years, and many of these projects have continued to expand and accelerate this year. Now, an area of immunotherapy that you may have heard about in the popular press involves something called immune checkpoint inhibitors. We know that tumor cells will often hijack our own immune cells to create an environment that actually blocks and suppresses the immune system. Now, many groups have developed ways to retrain the immune system by blocking these immunosuppressive cells to create a stronger response by what is known as immune checkpoint blockade. And in a group of patients with recurrent glioblastoma, a team from Dana-Farber targeted a well-known pathway in these immune response that contributes to the immunosuppression that's associated with tumors. And this pathway was known as VEGF. They used a strong combination therapy treatment strategy, including a well-known drug to block the VEGF pathway. This is known as Avastin or bevacizumab. You may have heard of it. And alongside a checkpoint inhibitor that blocks PD-1, also called nivolumab. And this novel combination treatment was very well tolerated in patients, and further studies are ongoing to evaluate its effectiveness. Now, other groups are combining immune checkpoint inhibitors with vaccine-based therapies. There's a group from China that combined checkpoint inhibitors with a dendritic cell vaccine, found that they could achieve longer survival and was more effective with longer treatments. So combination strategies remain a very important avenue with immunotherapy to target the tumor from many angles. Another exciting strategy that was discussed at ASCO was the use of vaccines to kill brain tumors. Similar to the vaccines that we're all familiar with common infections, you know, you take your vaccine for polio and all those other infectious diseases. Well, cancer vaccines are unique, and they target the very machinery inside the tumor cells. That's very specific, only for tumor cells, and create a very highly selective treatment for brain tumors. So these dendritic cell vaccines are particularly interesting because they use the patient's own tumor cells, and these cells are responsible for presenting the information about the tumor to what we are calling killer T cells, which are part of the immune system. So an exciting study this year highlighted the use of a personalized dendritic cell vaccine where the patient's own tumor was used to create this personal vaccine. And in patients with newly diagnosed glioblastoma, the dendritic vaccine showed a very favorable immune response, and preliminary data results showed that it slowed the tumor's growth. Now, another area of investigation is the use of engineered viruses called oncolytic viruses. These are designed to selectively target tumor cells. And in a recent phase one trial in recurrent glioblastoma patients, a novel oncolytic virus was directly injected into the patients, into the spinal fluid in the brain, and found that treatment led to a very strong immune response and slowed down the tumor growth. And this was all done with very few side effects. And given the potential here to generate a favorable immune response, this was a very promising study and is going to be continued in the future. Now, at this point, there have been many studies looking at new chemotherapies for patients. And one problem is how to get enough of the drug into the brain past the protective blood-brain barrier in the brain that prevents drugs from actually getting into the brain and into the tumor. And one strategy involved the use of local delivery, where a group from Duke and UCSF completed a study where they targeted an inflammatory protein that was overexpressed in glioma. It's called IL-4. And this is for tumors where surgery was not an option. And the drug was delivered with a technique called convection-enhanced delivery, where a drug is slowly infused directly into the tumor and the brain through a catheter that's implanted surgically. When drugs are given this way, you not only achieve very high drug concentrations in the tumor, but you avoid all the side effects that occur when you have to give a drug intravenously or in a pill form, where the drug has to travel through the rest of the body. And these investigators found that the local drug treatment could achieve longer survival with limited side effects compared to standard treatment. And so they're now preparing a subsequent phase 3 trial. I want to finish up the update by telling you about some interesting studies with new approaches to get information on brain tumors from a technique called a liquid biopsy. A liquid biopsy is a method of taking blood from a patient and analyzing it to analyze proteins and see whether there's a tumor present and how it's responding to treatment. Turns out that all tumors, not just brain tumors, release microscopic pieces of tumor into the bloodstream that can be actually analyzed and used for diagnosis and treatment response. And other studies have found that understanding these changes in brain tumors that are reflected in the blood are a way of allowing us to actually map the changes that are taking place in tumors. And this is where things like artificial intelligence and machine learning are being used to analyze these big groups of data. So with the last few minutes I have, I want to talk a little bit about quality of life concerns. This starts by making sure you can communicate with your healthcare team. First of all, important to seek reputable specialists. It's helpful to find people who are specialists specifically in brain tumors, and it's easier than ever now to find these people through the use of the internet. And also working with great support groups and groups like cancer care, all of this can be easily accomplished. Now, when you go to see your doctor, there's some questions to ask. Here's a number of questions. What options do I have for treatment? What are the risks and the most common side effects of treatment? Should I have a second opinion? Do I need to start treatment right away? What's the most effective way to communicate with you and your team? It's important to have control over your lifestyle. Given the inconvenience of seeing doctors and getting tests and treatments, keep a notebook or use your smartphone to jot down notes and reminders, and this will help you to make sure that you're not overwhelmed by dealing with your condition. This way, when you see your doctor, you can make sure that your questions are answered, and you can make sure that your instructions are understood. You also want to make sure that other health professionals, such as your primary care doctor, are kept informed so they can coordinate your overall care. It's important to keep an eye on us, dialogue with your family so they understand what you're going through and can help you make decisions. Also, I would be skeptical of anecdotes, whether they're personal anecdotes that someone tells you or whether you see it on the internet, no matter how well-meaning they are. There are no two patients who are exactly alike, and I'd be careful about trying to apply something you've heard about another patient to your specific case. It may also be useful to have second opinions if time's available, and having other opinions can help you refine and reformulate your questions. So it's important to work with your healthcare team and friends and family to maintain the highest quality of life possible. It's important to pursue these activities that help your overall physical wellness. This means all of the standard recommendations to living your best possible life. That includes exercise through physical activity, preferably something that you enjoy doing. Mental activity, including hobbies like writing, reading, arts and crafts, cooking, or anything else that stimulates you. And along these lines, you want to engage in things that you love to do, whether it's activities, passions, or being around the people that you enjoy most. Being able to spend time with your cherished family and friends will not only be uplifting, but likely has beneficial effects on your overall health. Finally, getting the proper amount of sleep and rest and proper attention to diet and nutrition. So having a good quality of life is very doable. Just because you have a brain tumor, no one is saying that you can't visit a mall, enjoy a birthday party, have a nice meal, or see a good movie. It's important to continue your life, living your life to the highest degree possible, despite any diagnosis or side effects that you're having. This is by far the best way to cope with your tumor. So in closing, I just want to remind you that there's some outstanding laboratories and researchers who are working with brain tumors and making considerable promise, and there's more optimism now for finding better treatments and improving the quality of life than there's ever been before. So thank you for your attention. I'll turn this back over to Carolyn for the next speaker.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. That was just an outstanding presentation and lots of great information, and also leaving people with the concept that the quality of life, that they really can spend time enjoying what they love to do, which could include going to a movie, spending time with family and friends, all the things that you mentioned. So thank you for that. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Misikowitz, and Dr. Misikowitz is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology, and Medical Oncology, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Clinical Director of Research in Head and Neck, Clinical Director of the Center for Personalized Cancer Therapeutics, the Tisch Cancer Institute, and Chairman of the Oncology, Pharmacy, and Therapeutics Committee. And Dr. Misikowitz will be addressing specific updates on the treatment of oral and head and neck cancer presented at ASCO, and the management of treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Misikowitz.
So good afternoon, everybody. This is Dr. Krista Misikowitz. Everybody calls me Dr. Chris, just to simplify things, and thank you for this very kind introduction. So I want to start with some kind of a metaphoric explanation of immunotherapy, expand on the definition that you actually heard a few minutes ago, and actually I really enjoyed listening to this presentation. So kind of create a foundation and knowledge what we're talking about, because many of this medical terminology, actually, even for me as a physician, sometimes it's new and it's kind of hard to follow to understand. Some things I'm going to be covering, I'm going to be talking about immunotherapy and the vaccine, and I want to just expand a little bit on the definition that you have heard. So I see immunotherapy, I live in the United States, and in order to protect our country, we have many different forms. We have CIA, FBI, the police, the soldiers, Air Force, many different people that are kind of involved in the protection of our country, but not all of them, they're kind of on the refuge and they're kind of working. Some of them on the standby, some of them at the barrack, and basically there's only a small fraction of them kind of patrolling and making sure that our country is safe. And they're going to be only activated if they're going to see the outside enemy, if this enemy is going to be recognizable, if this enemy is going to be visible, sort of like when it happens when our body is invaded by the bacteria, our body kind of responds. Sometimes those troops, they can be kind of triggered by the internal, some kind of somebody pushed the button from the Pentagon to kind of say, search, because I think there's an enemy. And this is what really immunotherapy does. Basically what it does, because the cancer is invisible to our body. The body is kind of being tricked, and our body does not see. Sort of like the secret spy that is kind of trying to stay in the dark and just create the damage without us knowing, and it has to be discovered in order to be neutralized. So what we do with immunotherapy, basically we kind of push the button and we're saying that we need more troops on the street. We need more kind of different services to find for this spy and neutralize it. And this is what the immunotherapy basically does. It's using our own kind of resources to kind of identify the cancer, find it, and eventually you destroy it, because this is basically the purpose. So this is the immunotherapy, and you heard those like checkpoint inhibitors, or PD-1, or Keytruda, or pembrolizumab, or Opdivo. So all of them, they kind of work in this metaphorically explained fashion. So basically, we're mobilizing our own immune system in order to find the cancer and neutralize. And there's something else that we use. I'm going to mention something, therapeutic vaccines. Because if you're going to imagine right now, if I'm going to go to all those services, FBI, CIA, and I'm going to tell them, find the enemy or find the suspects, I'm not telling them any description how this suspect is going to look like. It's sort of like, If you see something suspicious, react. And this is what the immunotherapy or our immune system does. What the vaccine they do, I'm giving them the clearly descriptive instruction how this enemy is going to look like. It's sort of like when you saw in the old movies the rewards kind of picture of the criminal, and this is the picture that I'm giving to the immune system, and I say, I think this criminal, this is the cancer. This is how the cancer is going to look like. And if it, what you see on this picture, you see on the street or somewhere in the body, you react because I think it is the cancer. Because the vaccines, the way they're created, basically, we know how those cancer look like. We kind of explain to our immune system in the metaphoric way how this cancer can look like, and eventually, effectively, more effectively, obviously, the immune system can work. So having this in mind, immunotherapy is approved in the treatment of head and neck cancer. This is what we do. Normally, this is how we treat. So basically, we can mobilize all those different troops and kind of tell them to find the cancer. But because we're not satisfied with the results, we kind of say, okay, what's going to happen? If I'm going to train this immune system, I'm going to give them some kind of piece of the information, such as vaccine, and inform them how the cancer look like, maybe this treatment is going to be more effective. And the first study that I want to discuss actually is a combination of the immunotherapy that we already use in treatment of head and neck cancer. But in addition to this immunotherapy, we give the vaccine. And the vaccine is called CUE-101. There was a small study presented at ASCO with 24 patients for patients that had cancer that was caused by the HPV-16 virus. And basically what was a little bit unique about this vaccine, because this vaccine was not activating the entire immune system, like you can imagine CIA, FBI, police, and the Army at the same time, it was activating only a small fraction of specific T cells. So basically you can imagine only CIA being informed, not anybody else. But surprisingly, even the selective activation of the selective kind of training how the cancer looked like, the vaccine was able to deliver an amazing result. The response rate was really, really exciting, and it was really, really surprisingly high. So obviously this treatment looked very promising. Obviously the study was done only 24 patients, but if you're going to hear any study in the future that includes the vaccine and immunotherapy, so at least you're going to know what you're signing for. And in this case, obviously the patients, most of them, they benefited with a very, very good response rate, meaning that the cancer shrank, meaning was detected that the cancer got smaller after the successful treatment. And our vaccine study that was presented at ASCO, it was HB200. It included 46 patients, and it was the RNA vaccine. Then you can ask, what is the RNA vaccine? You can deliver this imaginary picture of the criminal by, you know, making, let's say, 1 million copies and redistributing through the entire body and giving everybody one copy. This is like a standard way. But you can also say, at the same time, what you can do, you can have three, let's say, copies go to the human body and say, you have a Xerox inside your body, maybe you can make those subsequent copies, and then maybe you can redistribute through the entire body. And actually, this is what the RNA vaccine, they do. They're using our own body to kind of duplicate or making a copy of this potential screenshot or photograph of the criminal, and eventually it's going to be redistributed through our body. So it's just slightly different. So with this 46 patients, again, the results were quite similar with the study that they presented before or explained it before. So it looks like there was a trend. So there are two positive trends that we saw with the combination of standard immunotherapy with the addition of giving the vaccine. And in both studies, they were targeting HPV-positive cancers in head and neck. And then there was a third study. Sometimes I have to present a study that maybe doesn't look or didn't look as good as the previous one. And in this study, what they did, they used the traditional vaccine, meaning that they used the oncoprotein. So it's sort of like me copying multiple or making copies of multiple criminals and kind of delivering this huge amount to the human body and training them and kind of how the criminal look like. And again, in this study, they used the vaccine plus immunotherapy. And the second arm, the patient received placebo and immunotherapy. So it was the phase 3 clinical study to show if maybe the addition of immunotherapy really in the race between those two, obviously it's going to show any benefit. And unfortunately, this study was negative. With this vaccine called ISA-101B, it was a negative study. Basically, what it showed, that unfortunately in this case, and that sometimes, you know, those things can happen, that this is the only way we're going to learn, that by addition of this vaccine to the immunotherapy, it doesn't do much. So basically, it was a negative study. So now I want to switch gears and talk about nasopharyngeal cancer. So nasopharyngeal cancer is a type of cancer that happens behind our nose. And it's actually very vicious and can be very aggressive, and obviously it has to be treated appropriately. So right now those patients with locally advanced disease are treated with a chemotherapy plus immunotherapy, which is standard, or chemotherapy only, to shrink the cancer. So basically we're trying to shrink the cancer before we're going to kill the cancer. And subsequently, after what all those patients they receive chemotherapy and radiation, which the purpose of this treatment is to kill the cancer. And it's very, very efficient. But obviously, we doctors, whenever we see 70%, we want to make it 80. If we see 20%, we want to make it 30. So basically, we're always working towards the improvement and having more patients successfully, obviously, being treated from cancer in a way that we can cure them. So even though that the current treatment was semi, I would say, satisfactory, we wanted to make it better. And in this study, what they did, they used the standard, and at some point they said, we're going to randomize the patient after chemotherapy and radiation to short course of immunotherapy after versus nothing. And surprisingly, the immunotherapy addition basically provided patients with the better outcome. There was less patients having distant metastases. There was less patients that the cancer kind of came back locally. But it was a positive study. It looks like that immunotherapy that can be given after chemotherapy and radiation can provide additional benefit to the patients, but obviously stopping the cancer from spreading. Another study that I want to discuss, I have just two more, it's called the pathway study. Many times, and I'm going to use another metaphor, I like to compare the cancer to like a weed in the garden. And obviously when you have the weed in the garden, you're trying to dig it out, you got the shovels, and try to make sure that all the roots, even tiny ones, are removed. Because you know, if there is any root or any seed that was left behind, the cancer, or in this case, the weed, is going to regrow. But sometimes it's impossible to get all the roots, or sometimes we're not going to be able to see some seeds around this area. And those patients, if this is the situation, by asking the surgeon, the pathologist, if they suspect that the surgery was suboptimal, or that not the entire cancer was removed, or maybe there were some seeds that were left behind, but we cannot see them because they're too small, we label those patients as high risk. And there are some categories. So many times, I, as a medical oncologist, I have this question from the surgeon, and they say, we had this patient, we removed this cancer like 2-3 times, or I'm not satisfied with the surgery because I think there is still some cancer left behind. Chris, what else can be done to minimize this chance that this cancer is going to come back? And previously, many times I had to say, everything was tested, nothing worked. So, I mean, there's nothing I can do. And that was obviously very disappointing. And in this case, what they did, they took all those patients that were labeled high risk. And those patients, it was 100 of those patients, were randomized to receive immunotherapy or not for 1 year. And in some of those categories, it was really surprising that we saw that this immunotherapy that was given for 1 year, that is minimally toxic, basically was able to help a huge fraction of patients, and the cancer didn't come back for quite a long time. So even though they were labeled by the high risk, they were significantly doing better than the patients that didn't receive immunotherapy. So it's quite possible that in the future, and this strategy is used in other cancers, different than head and neck, that when you give immunotherapy after chemotherapy and radiation, or even after the surgery, obviously those patients receiving immunotherapy, they do better. So I'm hoping that obviously there's going to be more research into this, and we can use the same strategy in head and neck cancer. And the last study that I want to discuss, maybe it's a little bit different. Many times as a physician, I'm asked if the regular radiation, and we're going to call it photon, is better or worse than the radiation that we call it the proton. And obviously there are many more facilities that are being built, and obviously the proton treatment or proton radiation is being used in combination with other treatments that we discussed today to treat the cancers. And what is the difference? The difference is basically because the photon machine, and I don't know exact numbers, let's say it costs $1 million, and it can be fitted in the small room. So that's why many hospitals, they have this equipment because it's affordable and because it can fit into the hospital. The problem with the proton, you don't need the small machine. You need a building. Actually, building in New York is like a five-family house that the machine has to be fit in, and it's just one, that the patients can be treated, and this is the proton. So you can imagine the cost is enormous, and that's why there are not so many of these facilities built in the country. But there is some kind of a promise and maybe hope that the proton treatment is better than the photon treatment, even though maybe it's going to be more costly and more expensive. So what they did, they randomized the patients with different kind of head and neck cancer patients, and they're trying to see if the proton treatment is worse than the current photon that we currently use. And the study showed that basically there is no difference in terms of the efficacy. So by using the proton treatment, the proton radiation, basically we're not subjecting the patient to the worst treatment. But what was interesting in the same study, that the proton treatment offers more precision. So basically, it can minimize the collateral damage. So you can imagine that less of your body is being radiated because it's more precise. So it seems, obviously, that obviously the precision factor may kind of be a contributory or give the advantage to the proton treatment. And I think it's extremely important because obviously in head and neck cancer patients, pain and discomfort and lack of taste and the difficulty swallowing and difficulty speaking, obviously it happens a lot when we treat those patients with chemotherapy and radiation because we burn. Because the radiation, no matter what, it's like a burning process, we're trying to burn the cancer. So if you can imagine tongue or your cheeks or your throat being burned, it's hard to talk, it's hard to swallow, and obviously those are extremely sensitive areas that patients can be suffering from a tremendous amount of pain. So any kind of strategy that can offer the precision that we can radiate less, even if the treatment is equally efficacious as the previously used type of radiation like photon, obviously it's quite beneficial for our patient because it's going to provide them with less pain and less side effects like the chronic ones. It's something that you can carry for the rest of your life. So those are the studies that I want to discuss today as a part of the head and neck part. I want to thank all the speakers and the participants. And I just want to say that none of this cannot be done without your contribution. So if at any point you're considering participation in the clinical trials, something that we discussed today, it cannot be done with you. And I strongly encourage you to do so because the one story I can say that I have quite a few patients that I stopped the treatment and they're still alive, even though statistically speaking, long time ago they wouldn't be around. So it's very encouraging that they were brave to participate in the clinical trials and they can still have the benefits from the participation and have a relatively normal life and see the family and enjoy as much as they can. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mystikowicz. That was just a wonderful presentation and actually very very interesting in terms of using metaphors to kind of help people understand the treatments that are being used. And I think that was just a terrific presentation. So thank you so much. I want to just thank you very much for that presentation. And our next speaker and our last speaker is Dr. Priscilla Merriam. And Dr. Merriam is Senior Physician, Medical Oncology, Clinical Director, Sarcoma Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Merriam we'll be discussing specific updates on the treatment of sarcoma presented at ASCO, and she also will do the concluding wrap-up of Part 1. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Merriam.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. I'm really pleased to be here to join you and the other speakers today to review the sarcoma highlights from the 2024 ASCO Annual Meeting. One of the exciting changes in the sarcoma track this year was a format change to include a rapid oral abstract session. These abbreviated oral abstract presentations allowed us to hear results directly from more of the investigators. In this year's group of reported abstracts, we saw further development of immunotherapy approaches, interesting treatment combinations, and targeted therapies. Within the rapid oral abstract session, there were several abstracts presented for studies conducted for patients with angiosarcoma. Dr. Kim and colleagues presented a phase 2 study of the chemotherapy drug paclitaxel in combination with the immunotherapy drug avelumab for patients with sarcoma that could not be removed with surgery. Most of the people who participated in the study had never before received chemotherapy. Close to one-third of patients had angiosarcomas that started on the scalp, and almost 70% of participants had their angiosarcoma start inside the body or in visceral sites. Results of this small study of only about 32 people were encouraging, with close to half of the individuals experiencing significant tumor improvement with a combination of paclitaxel plus avelumab. Dr. Van Ravenstein and colleagues also presented a phase 2 study of an immunotherapy drug called cemiplimab, a checkpoint inhibitor, in patients with angiosarcoma. Participants in this study had angiosarcoma that was felt to have developed from either sun exposure, prior radiation as a cancer treatment, or as related to chronic swelling, also known as lymphedema. 2/3 of participants had angiosarcoma that was felt to have arisen after radiation therapy. There were encouraging tumor shrinkage in about one-third of participants. Interestingly, the investigators looked at a measurement in patient tumor samples to assess the level of something called tumor mutational burden. In some cancers, a high tumor mutational burden is associated with the response to immunotherapy checkpoint inhibitors. In this small study, there were some individuals with important tumor shrinkage whose cancer had a low tumor mutational burden, yet they still responded to the immunotherapy drug. Given that the number of people treated on this clinical trial was small, this interesting information adds to a larger evaluation of whether tumor mutational burden is helpful in predicting response to immunotherapy in sarcomas or not, but we have to be cautious about drawing big conclusions from the small number of samples tested in this study. We also heard the important follow-up to the Alliance randomized phase 2 study of the chemotherapy drug paclitaxel given with or without the checkpoint inhibitor nivolumab in individuals with angiosarcoma who had never previously received paclitaxel. 1 year prior, at ASCO 2023, Dr. Grilly Olson had presented results from the portion of the study that included people with angiosarcoma who had previously received paclitaxel. In that group of people who had already been treated with paclitaxel, there was evidence that the combination of the oral drug, cabozantinib, plus the immunotherapy drug, nivolumab, had significant anti-tumor activity against angiosarcoma. During this year's ASCO presentation, Dr. Grilly Olson presented the results from the group of individuals who never had received paclitaxel and who were randomly assigned to receive paclitaxel or randomly assigned to receive paclitaxel plus nivolumab. The conclusions from the results of this portion of the study were that both paclitaxel and paclitaxel plus nivolumab were effective in treating angiosarcoma. While it is possible that certain subgroups of types of angiosarcoma may have different responses to different treatments, there's more to learn about the potential role of immunotherapy and immunotherapy combinations in the treatment of angiosarcoma. Also within the rapid oral abstract session, results were presented from a small study of individuals with a rare type of sarcoma called alveolar soft part sarcoma. In 2022, atezolizumab, an immunotherapy drug, was approved for treatment of alveolar soft part sarcoma based on very encouraging results in clinical trials. In the small phase 2 study presented by Dr. Liu, individuals received the combination of an oral medication called anlotinib, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, plus an investigational anti-PD-L1 immunotherapy drug. In a study with 29 people with alveolar soft part sarcoma, the investigators reported almost 80% of participants had significant shrinkage of their cancer with the treatment. This was a very encouraging result. However, since the study was very small, we have to be cautious in drawing conclusions. We look forward to further investigation of this type of approach in larger studies, which we hope will provide more information. There were a number of studies presented with results that were highly anticipated in the oral abstract session. Dr. Tapp presented the results of the phase 3 MOTION trial of the drug called vimseltinib in patients with tenosynovial giant cell tumor, sometimes referred to as TGCT. This study was an international study in which people with TGCT were randomly assigned either to receive vimseltinib or to receive placebo. Neither the patient nor the doctor was told if the patient was assigned to receive vimseltinib or to receive placebo. People who were initially treated with placebo had the opportunity to receive vimseltinib if there was evidence of worsening of their TGCT. as compared to placebo, results from the group of people treated with vimseltinib were very encouraging in terms of decrease in the size of the TGCT and in terms of improvement in symptoms and joint mobility. Additionally, vimseltinib was well tolerated. It's very encouraging to know that there may be another treatment available in the future that might be helpful for people living with TGCT. Results from the randomized multicenter study of radiation and surgery with or without pembrolizumab were of great interest to many people. This study included individuals with intermediate or high-grade undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma or liposarcoma that was in only one part of the body, in an area that could be easily accessible to surgeons, such as in the arms or the legs. For all participants to be eligible for the study, their doctors must have recommended preoperative radiation followed by surgery as the best approach for management of their localized sarcoma. Half of the participants in the study proceeded with the standard treatment plan of preoperative radiation followed by surgery. The other half of the participants were treated with preoperative radiation prior to surgery, but this group also received the immunotherapy drug pembrolizumab while they were receiving radiation, as well as after surgery, for a total of 1 year of treatment with pembrolizumab. Over 100 people participated in the study from around the world. Over 80% of people who participated were diagnosed with undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma. Data are still preliminary from the study, but early results suggest that perhaps pembrolizumab may contribute to control of sarcoma for some patients when given along with radiation. Further data will be analyzed and followed over time to provide a greater understanding of the potential role of adding pembrolizumab to preoperative radiation and surgery for people who have sarcoma in only one location in the outer part of their body. Continuing on the theme of immunotherapy and combinations of immunotherapy and other treatments, a group of European investigators presented results from a large trial called ImmunoSARC-2, a phase 2 study of the tyrosine kinase inhibitor sunitinib and the immunotherapy checkpoint inhibitor nivolumab. The results were presented for patients with dedifferentiated chondrosarcoma, a rare sarcoma subtype, who were treated with a combination of sunitinib and nivolumab. Patients were initially treated with sunitinib alone for 2 weeks, and then nivolumab was added. Results were available for 19 patients. Results were quite encouraging in the small number of participants, with an important number of people having tumors that decreased in size and others whose tumors stabilized in size. This was a very intriguing result. There was some good news from a small phase 2 study for patients with advanced osteosarcoma. In this study, something called an antibody-drug conjugate was given to patients whose osteosarcoma had grown despite prior treatment with chemotherapy. This treatment is targeted to a protein that is frequently found on the surface of osteosarcoma cells. The idea is that antibody-drug conjugate medication will selectively bind to osteosarcoma cells where it can directly deliver a package of chemotherapy in a controlled fashion. The results were encouraging, with researchers describing tumor shrinkage in a number of people whose osteosarcoma had previously been treated with chemotherapy. Finally, results of a multicenter phase 2 study in patients with Ewing sarcoma were presented by Dr. Grohar. This study included 18 people with Ewing sarcoma who in general had previously received many prior treatments for their cancer. In the study, participants received a chemotherapy drug called trabectedin, administered over a short period of time as compared to the standard infusion time, along with a chemotherapy drug called irinotecan, as it also administered in a novel schedule. This approach is based on lab research and previously reported clinical trial data suggesting that for patients with the genetic changes seen in Ewing sarcoma, giving trabectedin over a shorter period of time and in combination with irinotecan seems to make the benefit of trabectedin even stronger. Indeed, in this small study, there were very encouraging results with this approach, even for people who had previously received many types of chemotherapy, and even for people who had previously received irinotecan. The investigators are considering how to further develop this approach in additional clinical trials. The reports of promising results presented in the sarcoma track were a reminder that of the progress that we make every year by thinking creatively about how to use medications that we already have available, and opportunities from new types of medications. The meeting always confirms our belief that we can make an important difference in improving the treatment of even very rare sarcomas, and that answers to important clinical questions can be asked and answered quickly with the important collaborations the sarcoma community has developed both within the United States and internationally. The organizers of the ASCO 2024 annual meeting are tremendously dedicated individuals who work throughout the year to bring the state-of-the-art research results and clinical care advances for people living with cancer and to those who support them. The education experts among the ASCO leadership shared their commitment to optimizing how presenters communicate their message based on how adults learn best, and also to improve how we communicate research findings to non-clinicians. Each presenter was asked to include a summary slide of key points early on in the presentation, as well as a lay summary slide to make the information more readily available to all people. This commitment to ensuring that critical information is accessible to all people fits with the mission of the 2023-2024 ASCO President, Dr. Lynn Schuchter, to focus on both the art and science of cancer care. Her message throughout this year has been for the ASCO community to continue to make incredible advances in cancer treatment, but also to keep the focus on the human side of cancer treatment, including providing supportive care and compassion at every moment possible, and to make sure that we provide comprehensive care to people living with cancer as well as to their families and supporters. The annual ASCO meeting is unlike any other cancer meeting, inspiring researchers around the world to continue their work of improving treatment for people with cancer. But all of the exciting new information we share with each other is possible only because of the openness of people with cancer who decide to participate in clinical trials, looking for better treatment for themselves and for others like them. This meeting is a reminder of the critical foundation created by relationships between patients and all the people working to improve the care of patients with cancer. The community created by all these amazing people is the reason we work every day to learn more about cancer, about treatments for cancer, about the lives and priorities of people living with cancer, so we can work together to make cancer care better and better. Thank you to everyone for the part you play. And make sure that you talk with your treatment team to find out about how to participate in clinical research trials if that is something that is right for you. Thank you again for inviting me to participate in this cancer care webinar. It's always a great privilege. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Miriam. That was just a wonderful presentation on sarcoma and also a wonderful wrap-up of really the purpose of ASCO and how patients and clinicians work together to enhance care. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Wonderful presentation. And I just want to conclude by just giving our participants just a little bit of information about cancer care. Cancer Care Off has a number of free programs and services nationally, both through our HOPE line, which is 1-800-813-4673, or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. And the services include both a practical, financial, and co-payment assistance. We do offer a number of online support groups. We also offer resource navigation, educational workshops like today's workshop that you all participated on. We also have pet assistance program, which assists people who have a cat or a dog for whom they might be too ill to care for. And so we do offer assistance both in having someone help them care for their pet, take their dog for a walk or change the litter box, or help them with the cost of food for their pet. Our financial assistance program also assists with the cost of food for people living with cancer who call us for help as well. And you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. There are just a host of services that you can access from our website, even more than I've mentioned today. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.